Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Dance, Music, Sex, Romance podcast. I'm your host, Zachary Hoskins, and I'm here once again with two panelists from the University of Salford Purple Rain Conference. I'm talking to Chris Aguilar Garcia. Is that?
Yes.
Is that I'm not good with Spanish. I have a very Anglo pronunciation of the Spanish words, but
that was acceptable.
Okay, good. And Natalie Clifford, and you guys were both on a gender and sexuality panel right from the beginning when I started doing these podcasts about Prince. This is an area that I'm really interested in, so I'm really glad to have the opportunity to talk to you two. Just go down the line, I guess. So Chris, tell me a little bit about your background. I understand you're sort of not an academic, but you're in academia at the moment.
Correct. I'm currently completing a bachelor's degree program at Antioch University, Los Angeles, and I'm doing that as a liberal studies major and a queer studies minor, which kind of then plays into my specific topic, which was the revolutionary queerness of Prince, looking at how his actions were queer within the regard of looking at the framework of sexuality, new power, and emancipation. So kind of taking those three ideas and how with each of those, he took a very queer approach to defining both what they were and then also in the way that it defined him as an artist, and very much as a way of life. That was another important component of mine. I think there's brief mention of this on your one of the earlier podcasts you did on the French esoteric, where they because I also had reference to Foucault in mind in terms of his idea of an artful life, and that was something that Prince very much embodied, just in that idea of, you know, it wasn't just that he went into the studio and recorded a track and then it was done. That was literally his entire existence was crafted and created, you know, by himself as how he wanted to live his life, of having a very intentional life in basically, you know, every approach to, you know, business, art, fashion. And so that was kind of the main gist of my work.
Oh, great. And now we got Nat, and you have a really interesting background. Nobody else I've talked to has come from quite this perspective, which is great. So tell me a little bit about, I guess, tell me about what you were doing at the time that you presented.
For sure. Thank you for having us on here. It's a real neat opportunity, and Chris and I, having been on the same panel, it's cool to get to talk with him again about this. We had a real enriching set of conversations at the conference. Currently I'm a sixth grade math teacher, but prior to that point, the work I was doing at the time was through a rape crisis center. And so I was in the field of sexual violence prevention. And so what I was doing that I spoke about at the conference was working with middle and high school age youth to discuss boundaries, consent, gender, sexuality, healthy relationships, unhealthy relationships, and dating violence. And so a lot of the work that I spent my time doing was with middle school aged boys, or you could say, you know, students who were presumed to identify as male. So there's a whole lot around that. But what I would do when I spoke with them was to have conversations about masculinity. And I happen to be from Minneapolis, so I love Prince, obviously. Unfortunately, I mean, I'm from a different generation of folks, but then the students I was working with are from an even, you know, much younger generation, and they really were not as familiar with him. And so it's not like I went off super tangentially about Prince all the time with them, but I did make a point to bring him up in the conversations I had with youth. So that kind of gets to my topic at the conference was I spoke about his unconventional expression of masculinity and the ways that he really not just push boundaries, because I feel like that phrase gets thrown around a lot about masculinity, but he really created new space for younger generations to explore unconventional ways of expressing their gender, whatever gender they may identify with, and that he, through his legacy and while he was alive still, encouraged people to be creative within that and beyond what has been constructed for us, you could say. We'll get to this later, I'm sure, but one thing I did also mention was that I am under no illusion that that is all totally accepted by everyone in society right now. There's still a lot of backlash and violence against people who do push back on those expectations, which is part of why the work I was doing was to prevent that, you know, to educate people at a younger age so that they would not see that kind of transgression, I guess you could say, as a negative thing, but as simply, human right, really. So, yeah.
That's again, like, I can't wait to kind of dig deeper into this, but let's sort of continue with some background. Both of you are coming into this academic conference from similar backgrounds in the sense that, you know, you're, both of you have studied queer and gender theory. I'm curious how you got into Prince, each of you, because, it's kind of an obvious connection. Prince is definitely an artist who lends himself to queer and gender theory readings, as we've seen in some of my other conversations. Right. But it's always interesting to hear like where the professional side of things connects with just the personal interest in Prince. So I guess actually let's start with you, Nat, because you mentioned you're from Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm. So as far as kind of how I got into Prince, so I my folks are from Chicago. I moved to Minnesota when I was pretty young, and I grew up in the suburbs outside of the Twin Cities. But then I ended up going to college in Minneapolis, and so I kind of say that I feel like I came of age in the actual city of Minneapolis because I lived there for a number of years while in school and after getting out of school. And so I was familiar with Prince growing up because my father is just really, really into music, and so we would have, you know, family dance party, just goofy stuff. I come from a big family, and so I was really familiar with his music, but I wouldn't say by any extent, you know, all kinds of his music. It was really just kind of the main things that were popular. And then when I went to college, I had never actually seen Purple Rain, even though I had grown up in Minnesota, because the way I was raised was fairly socially conservative, and that's its own whole thing. But so my parents didn't want me to see it, and so then when I went to college, actually, people were like, "You're from here, you haven't even seen this movie." I was like, I felt very behind, honestly, which I was really. And then I remember seeing it for the first time, and it totally embarrassed me actually a bit. It shocked me a lot, just given the way that I had grown up. I also I am part of the queer community. And that was kind of part of my coming out process, was starting to, not just Prince, but other things that, you know, as you said, he kind of bleeds into all of these communities, his influence does. And so I then became very, very avidly interested in Prince at that time, really on my own, since, like I said, my folks weren't as familiar really with a lot of, they kind of sheltered the extent of his influence, I guess you could say.
Right.
So then I just came to grow and love Prince, and I really, part of the amazing thing for me at the conference was that myself being from a slightly different generation, it was really fascinating to me to hear from people like Chris and other folks who literally grew up hearing his music, that I feel like I'm still learning so much from everyone. And so when he had passed, I was no longer living in Minneapolis at the time, and I felt like nobody understood how upset I was. Because I think part of the reason that Prince means so much to me personally is because of the place of Minneapolis that I have spent so much of my life. And so a lot of my association with him is that place and the people there. So going to this conference was an amazing once-in-a-lifetime opportunity because I felt I got to represent my city and represent my own self, my queerness, but also my passion for social justice and youth work. And so I actually, my friends and family pitched in on a GoFundMe for me to go because they knew I so badly wanted to go and I couldn't afford it working at a nonprofit.
Right.
So that's kind of how I found myself there. I got to meet awesome people like Chris and a bunch of the folks you've talked to. So that's my nutshell. I'm sorry, I'm long-winded. So cut me off when you need to.
we're all, I think everyone I've had on this podcast is long-winded to some degree. So if you don't mind me asking, how old are you? I think you're a little bit younger than me, maybe. I'm 33.
I'm 27, yeah.
Okay. So we're kind of in the same rough. You're around my sister's age, my younger sister. Yeah. It's interesting to talk to people who actually grew up with Prince. I always feel like I showed up to a party that was like almost over. and now I'm like trying to be, you know, present myself as an expert to some extent. So it is always interesting to be one of those people who are sort of playing catch up
forever.
Exactly. So Chris, Natalie kind of mentioned, and I've heard you on other podcasts before, so I sort of know your story, but why don't, let's share it with the listeners. You are one of those people who sort of grew up with Prince. Is that correct?
That is very correct. I'm 46. And I discovered Prince with the 1999 album. It was probably 1983. But, you know, from that point became obsessed. So it, you know, has now been a very important part of my life for, you know, over 30 years. So the majority of my life, and particularly as well, I am a queer man. So particularly at that point, you know, I was about 12 when I discovered him. So it was right at that age where I was, you know, coming to terms with identity. And so that, I think, was a huge part of me finding a place of feeling okay with who I was, because there was just, you know, there were no other examples of that in mainstream media at the time. And not even, you know, Prince isn't gay, obviously, that wasn't although, you know, at the time I wasn't sure of that, which was, you know, just because of, you know, what you know, how we're socialized around sexuality and masculinity and femininity. But for me at the time, that in itself was really a lifesaver, to see a man who was, you know, wearing makeup and wearing heels and singing about sex and, you know, not having like shame around the idea of sex and sexuality. So it just, you know, it was a very, very strong connection, you know, all of that. And then the groundwork being that the music was amazing, you know, that in itself. And then to have all of this extra added, it was something I really needed at that time, because I was not getting that in any other realm, you know, even to the point that at the time, when I first discovered Prince, I was listening to KDKO, which was the black radio station at the time. And it was, you know, a few years after the big, like, disco sucks movement. And, you know, I grew up in a neighborhood that was not very diverse. So there very much was, among my peer group, very much became like, oh, disco sucks, we all listen to rock. And so then I, you know, had to keep my KDKO, like, you know, R&B and soul listening habits to myself. And so then even that, you know, and then that's the only place Prince was being played when I first heard the 1999 album. And then in very short order, you know, he had the crossover both on radio and MTV. And so as well, it was something that gave me a sense of, here's a representation of me that I can show to other people, about this is who I am, and this is the world that I want to be a part of.
So I was, you sort of answered the question that occurred to me that I was going to ask, because I was thinking, so like 1983, there are some figures in popular music who are either openly gay or sort of queer presenting in some ways. I mean, you know, like during the disco era, you had Sylvester,
right?
Not that he was ever Prince level famous, you know, but and then, you know, even like around the same time as Prince, you had Boy George in Culture Club, and but like those seem different to me, and so I think part of it might be because of this rock disco or pop divide. You know, maybe Prince was and you know, let me know if you disagree, but I'm wondering if maybe Prince was perceived as a little more serious than somebody who came from more of a disco background or from more of a pop background, because he was such a you know, an incredible musician, and because he was a little more accessible in that rock framework. You know, that is what kind of set him apart from these other figures.
Right. I mean, yeah, I think that's part of it. I think as well, you know, on that, the rock tip, that what particularly as it pertained to mainstream and white audiences, you know, he came in with the endorsement of the Rolling Stones and John Cougar Mellencamp. So he had that cred as well. And then he had, you know, by his own design, the revolution of a very diverse band that as well, I think it made that pop crossover, I think, much easier, and to, you know, where it wasn't just defined as disco or R&B, that it was, you know, a mix of all of those things. And that was something that I think Prince very much, you know, wanted that perception as well, that it was something very, very unique, but inclusive in that way of, you know, that it represented a lot of different strands of the influences that he had heard. And yeah, it was definitely, I think, in terms of even when you're looking at, say, like the masculinity, femininity, that I think he definitely was seen in very different light than say Boy George, for instance.
Yeah, do you think is it because of the, like, the guitar phallus, or is it because there was a little bit of ambiguity? Like, I don't think anyone saw Boy George as anything other than a gay man. Like, I wonder why Prince's sort of masculinity was seen as a little more acceptable.
Well, I mean, I think also just a lot of it is kind of, you know, where we were with the entire, like, LGBT community at that point, which was, if you didn't say if you didn't out loud identify as being a part of that, it was assumed that you were not. So I think that too, George Michael wasn't out at that time. Elton John, I think, was either identified as bi or didn't really talk about it. You know, I think to the masses, Freddie Mercury was not out. I mean, it was a lot of times it wasn't questioned, you know, it just wasn't as much. And for that matter too, I will say that, you know, I think now Prince very much has that respect as a rock artist and a guitarist. But I think in terms of that really wide embrace of that part of Prince, I feel like that was really something that happened after like 2004 and Musicology and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I feel for when he was a big pop star, he was a pop star and not a rock star. I mean, I think he was seen at those levels, but he wasn't Bruce Springsteen. He was, you know, within that, the triumvirate of Michael Jackson, Madonna, and Prince. He was a pop artist in terms of how he was regarded by most mainstream art audiences.
And the ride, I say the ride is out. You must be.
Let's, before we get to the conference, let's talk a little bit about this distinction between queer and gay, right? Because, you know, I think something that I brought up at the time that this will be on the internet, the previous episode was a discussion with a guy named Paul Bonomo about Prince's sort of importance to the gay community, his the influence. We kind of said both ways, but obviously the influence on the gay community is easier to prove than the influence from the gay community to Prince. You know, one thing that I mentioned is that I don't, obviously Prince is not he's not a gay artist, but I do think of him as a queer artist in terms of the way that he presented himself and the way that he blurred those kind of boundaries in gender, not only gender presentation, but even just in the way that he sort of narratively inhabits these songs. But obviously at the time, queer theory was not really a thing,
right?
But how would the two of you connect Prince to queer theory or to queerness in general?
Wow. Well, so yeah, I think it's interesting too, because as I was approaching the paper and thinking, particularly in terms of presenting at the conference, you know, that was a lot of my mind space was in how, where do I start from in terms of bringing queer into the conversation of, you know, do I have to do like a whole background of this is what I mean by queer, like here's right. queer history and these are the ideas and this is the theory, you know, that do I have to start it out with saying, you know, does the opening line need to be, I am not saying Prince is gay, you
right.
know, that, you know, because I had seen, Zahir Ali on his some Instagram posts that he had done prior mm-hmm. to the conference that were Prince related was speaking of queerness, and definitely I saw from some people where there was pushback of right. you know, Prince is not queer because of that, you know, misconception that queer is equals gay,
right, right.
And I think that's the important distinction, is that queer does not equal gay, and that queer can be gay and gay can be queer, but they're not necessarily, or not always, and so it is, I mean, it's in that regard. Just, you know, queer theory is kind of confusing in that sense, but that's also kind of the whole point of queer is confusion.
Right.
You know, that we don't need to have an absolute of it's only this or it's only that, you know, and getting out of the binary and saying, you know, there's man and woman and left and right, and you know, that it's there's everything. And I think one of my instructors, queer theory instructor at Antioch, his mantra is there are an infinite number of ways to be a human being. And I think that really embodies the idea of queer, is that there is, for every single one of us, there we can define our own way of how we live and how we express ourselves. And, you know, probably for a lot of good reasons, we have, you know, in the past always gone away from that and said, no, we need to define ourselves completely in context of everyone else. Mm-hmm. And so that does then make it confusing to then bring in an idea that's like, no, let's not do it in terms of everyone else, but in, you know, in contrast to everyone else. And but that for sure, I mean, Prince, you know, both in his presentation and his work, but as well within the idea of being queer and not doing things the way they're supposed to be done, you know, saying I now have an unpronounceable name, or, you know, signing like the biggest recording contract and then writing slave on his face. And I mean, he consistently did things that were, you know, the opposite of what all conventional wisdom said should be done. And for the most part, he was always very successful in doing that. But even in the examples where he was not successful with that route, it was what he wanted to do, and he very much did not compromise. And I think that where that may be problematic as a person and with some individual relationships to not compromise. Right. As an artist, that's really admirable, and that's really difficult to do. I think particularly an artist working, you know, at the commercial level that Prince was for much of his career.
Take my name, I don't need it. Nothing stays the same anyway. Take my fame, I can't use it. My girlfriend calls me late. Yesterday, tell me what's my name. Tell me what's my name. What's my name?
I love hearing Chris talking. Like I said, this is part of, that sounds kind of goofy, but just in the sense, I mean, that this is part of why the conference was so rich of an experience, I think, for all of us that were able to attend, because you know, we have this shared context of, you know, being super fans of Prince, or whatever phrase you might actually want to use, you know, being part of the Purple family. It's just, it's very enriching to get to continue to learn. And so as far as it goes for me, I think kind of like Chris, I would echo what he said that, so for myself, considering myself a millennial, the term queer, when I was coming out at, you know, the ways that we think about identity, I think, has shifted a lot, like Chris said, in the last couple of decades. And so I'm not going to say it doesn't matter if Prince was queer, but in some ways, I think that that's kind of like what Chris is speaking to, I think, speaks to the fact that I think he very much adamantly didn't want to be defined by other people's limitations or expectations or whatever it was, and even often, as Chris spoke to, chose to go against that in very particular and creative ways. I think that, you know, we were asked this question after our panel at the conference. We were asked by someone about Prince's comments that have been interpreted or perceived as homophobic. And what I said to that was, and our response kind of as a group, you know, was just that whether he likes it or not, you know, there is something that happens when an artist creates music and puts it out into the world, the way that it's consumed and that people interact with it, that is out of their control, and they know that. And I think he knew that. And so it's not to excuse some of the things that he said, but I would say, I think I would use the term queer as a verb in the context of Prince. I would say that, like Chris said, he queered different things. So, like, in the sense that yes, you may not even identified as being part of whatever you want to use, whether it's the alphabet soup of LGBTQ or the term queer. But I do think that he had a huge influence, obviously. I believe that strongly from what I spoke about. But I also, I want to give a shout out to Joy Ellison, whose paper I didn't get to attend. But Joy Ellison, their paper was about the groundwork that was laid for Prince by resistance from trans women of color, queer and trans people of color in the 60s. And so he's kind of right in that age when he was growing up. And so their argument, I don't mean to misrepresent, but my understanding of what they argue is that, in fact, it does go both ways in some ways, I think, with Prince. And I would echo that, because I think that he did, whether consciously or not, he was able to do what he did because of the work and activism of people prior to him. But then I also think he did lay that groundwork then for future generations. So whether or not he identifies with that, to me, is a little beside the point, just because I think that, like Chris said, the work that he did as an artist was to challenge what was constructed and expected and violently, you know, norms are violent, right? And these are norms that are violently forced upon people and that have violent consequences. And so I think in a lot of ways, I think of when I say that he queered those things, was that it was a challenge to systems of violence that oppress and harm people.
I've definitely heard and seen interviews of Prince where he talks about, sort of being bullied for, I think he said something to the effect of, going around as a young person dressed like he did, he had to learn how to fight or something like that. So, I do think that's a really interesting perspective to view this in, you know, regardless of whether he was taking on a certain identity, he was definitely, he was definitely against these sort of categories and these limitations, which, as you said, can, are not only inconvenient, but are often like physically harmful to people. Yeah.
Right. You know, and on that, idea of violence as well. I just recently, in doing further work around the area, read the transcript from his interview with Oprah in 1996. And in a question that started out about the name change, she's like, "So your new name is the male and female symbol?" And he responded that he had been going through therapy, and that in therapy he discovered that there was another person inside of him. Right. And then said that they didn't know yet what the gender of that person was. And then in further conversation, I think she had earlier asked if he had been teased about his size. And then he comes back in this conversation about the name and says, "Well, this person, became a part of me around the age I was 5, and it was probably in response to, being teased and the names that I was called for being a small person." So that too, I think that, again, with identity and norms, speaking about violence and how that does, push people to say, who are you? And sometimes, fortunately, can then be that strength to help people figure out who they are.
That's really fascinating. And there's kind of the idea of the two different people, one of them possibly female, it's interesting. I recently, the woman that I interviewed a couple of episodes back now, Erica Thompson, she's writing this, a book about Prince's like spiritual progression.
Right.
And she interviewed several people. One of the people she interviewed was Robin Power from the Graffiti Bridge movie. And apparently in this interview, Robin Power, I don't know what to do with this to be, I don't even know where I'm going to go with this. I just wanted to mention it because Robin Power would only use gender neutral pronouns to describe Prince. She actually like deliberately avoided calling him he. And I just thought that was fascinating. I've never seen somebody do that before.
Right.
But I mean, it feels weirdly appropriate.
Right.
but yeah, I just thought that was so interesting. And I'd like to I'd like to find out more about why she made that choice, I guess.
Right. Right. No, and that's in fact in Erica, yeah, was another, fortunately, one of the great people that I got to spend a considerable amount of time with in conversation, as I'm also really interested in the spiritual and religious aspects. But you're right, when she did the post about Robin Power, I think she tagged both Nat and I and was like, I think you guys will really be interested in this. I think it definitely will be referenced in my work.
And I think that it is interesting too, because it sort of gets to the root of a lot of these conversations that we're having, which is the limitations of language, in connection as well. When Prince changed, I'm going to try it out. I'm going to use the day just because that makes sense in my head. When Prince started using the symbol instead of their name, I think that speaks to, he was such an intellectual and so highly critical of these systems, not just, internally, but in every aspect of his life I do it with the pronouns. But I think the other thing about that is, in the work that I was doing this past year, we spoke a lot about, instead of this idea of, there's often this term of, the binary, like Chris was referencing, as far as gender goes, there's kind of binary gender, and then there's, trans or gender nonconforming folks, and there's kind of this language that's sort of just lumps people who don't fit into this constructed binary as like, okay, well, then you're just kind of over in this... it's very othering a lot of the times, the language. And I think that someone I was working with, actually through Department of Health, while I was, it was in New Mexico that I was working, identified as queer and then came to identify as non-binary. And we talked about the language of they, and we talked also about how to support young people instead of thinking of gender as a restrictive kind of category, as expansive. And so they actually even introduced on some state surveys they were administering about gender and violence with kids, they started to shift using the term instead of gender nonconforming kids, or not like you don't fit this thing, it's very like negative stigmatizing type language, to gender expansive youth, which I thought was really interesting because I had never thought of it that way, and I think that's really powerful. And so I think that's sort of tangential from the language of they, but I think so much of the time when we have some of these conversations around identity or gender, it's very like, well, these are the norms and you don't fit, and again, like I said, very kind of othering. But instead, to think of it as I think Prince really did, I don't think that Prince thought, and I don't mean to speak for him obviously, but it didn't seem from his art that he thought of himself as not fitting in a like negative way. He just really saw the richness of what gender, and gender obviously as intersecting with all of his other identities. Obviously it's informed by race and class, ethnicity, and all, and abilities, all of these different things interweave. But I think he really did, even if it wasn't in those words, did a lot to kind of expand what we think about with gender, instead of to restrict.
I was just going to say also that I, after I read that, the piece from Erica, it got me thinking, and I haven't gone back to watch any specific interview since, but I do recall that in a lot of interviews that Prince did answer questions as we. And at the time, I always thought that he was talking about like the band, because it was usually like in that reference of they're like, like, are you going to do this? And it's like, oh, well, we are. And so I always thought of it in that context. But I'm really curious now. I do want to go back and look at some of those and, with a different eye and see, if it was always really, clearly being... I'm speaking about Prince and the NPG, or if it was more of a like, if he did consider himself a we, so I am curious. I definitely want to look deeper into that.
Never since
I really like the idea of viewing the symbol through a queer lens. I think I have predominantly viewed it, and this is, you know, Prince explicitly framed it as a race issue, both with the slave that he writing the slave on his face, and with he compared himself to people like Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali. But I also do think that there's something about that, like you were saying, Natalie, about trying to transcend language and you know, whether that's specifically related to gender or, you know, I think gender is tied up, and gender and sexuality are both tied up in that, in the kind of restrictive ways that we use language. And I'm thinking, you know, that this is an impulse that he's had in his music for a long time. You know, you look at so many of his songs, even going all the way back to I Want to Be Your Lover, you know, it's like, I want to be your mother and your sister, you know, like he's constantly sort of making his identity more than just a single binary, this limited thing. He's always taking on multiple positions. And, that's very much just a major part of, I think, the themes of his work, really.
And I think it's tricky because even with, you know, the way we speak about it, I know this came up at the conference, justifiably so as well, just trying to be careful around the language of transcendence as well, with identities too, because, there were folks who spoke or made reference to on their panels. I believe it was on the panel with, tell me if you think I'm wrong, Chris, but I think it was a panel where there was Zahir Ali, Tarika Blackman, and Monique Morris speaking about, there were other black men before Prince who were challenging norms, right? Like Little Richard, I know, came up. I think, was it Rick James? I'm trying to think. I feel like I misquoted that, and so don't quote me on that. But in the sense that they're saying, you know, we have to be careful in our conversations about Prince. He was so transformative in a lot of ways, and really has had a huge impact and legacy. But he also came from somewhere, you know, and that he didn't invent, you know, some of his creativity. He synthesized a lot, and I think that he took it to another level. But he never transcended necessarily, you know, his own identities, because he still lived in the skin that he was in, you know, but he did push, I think he did push boundaries, definitely, and worked to question and critique those systems while still very much being, you know, a black man from Minneapolis, which is like, or Minnesota as a state is overall very white, and, you know, came from such a segregated, that town, I mean, I guess me being from there, there's just like, that's the place that I know best, that better than the other places, and I'm still learning so much just about the history of the ways that black musicians, like the barriers that existed there, and then the ways that they worked creatively through that. And so I think that's something for myself that I'm still needing to educate myself about, that, you know, I come from this lens of looking at and through queerness and all these things, but constantly having to remember in those discussions that it all obviously intersects at the same time, and that you can't just look at his gender or his sexuality without also then talking about, you know, how that overlapped with other parts of himself, and how all of that happened at the same time every day, you know, in his life.
Right.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess let's talk a little bit about the conference itself. You guys already mentioned a couple of the panels you saw. Did you get a sense? I know that, you know, talking to a couple of different people who presented, people were pleasantly surprised by the way that that race was foregrounded in the conference. How did you feel about the way gender and sexuality? Did you feel like there was a good amount of discussion around that, those issues? Or
I mean, I of course would like to see more,
right?
Or you know, but I mean, I think in terms of, you know, some side conversations that I had and just what was going on around the conference, there was some. I don't think it was a predominant theme in my experience. I think it definitely was more around, you know, race and legacy. And I think, you know, same thing of just kind of, you know, in these early stages of, you know, what is, how do we define Prince at this point, you know, and how do we, you know, keep all of these conversations going and furthering them. But definitely within that regard, still just based on, you know, some, you know, we, of course, we're not the only, the only sessions that were about gender and sexuality. And so among them, you know, the other presenters, and definitely, you know, just in all the different ways that people looked at Prince, there definitely were other areas where it came up as well, you know, or other sessions that were not necessarily about gender and sexuality where it still just came up, because that is, you know, a very, I think, integral part of his presentation.
I guess in general, I'm surprised, you know, there's definitely a lot of conversation around around Prince and gender and sexuality and to an extent queerness, but I sometimes am surprised that there isn't more just in the world in general. So I guess that was kind of what I was curious about, was whether it was maybe more represented at the conference than elsewhere that I've seen. And I do wonder, you know, maybe part of it is because people are reticent, especially given the way that he kind of leaned more into a more conventional approach to gender later in life. Maybe people are reticent to kind of to talk about him in that way. But I think especially his early work was so important in establishing and like you said, in sort of modeling for people, you know, different ways to be different ways to be male and different ways to be, you know, something other other than male, something, you know, kind of beyond those categories, that I would really like to see more talk around this, especially, you know, he's not around to be mad at us anymore, so yeah. He might as well.
right. And you know, I see both positive and negative things about it not being discussed. And I think on the positive side, I think that just where, you know, where Prince did come to be, I think, just kind of universally embraced, I think it is a real positive that the ideas of the ways that he were different or was different are not a forefront of the conversation about him, that it's just accepted of like, oh, well, that's Prince. The unfortunate part about it, I think, again, goes back to binary, that I think then where, and conflating, you know, queer and being lesbian or gay or, you know, which, whatever realm of the, identity spectrum, but, that it kind of diminishes the conversation around Prince of just saying like, well, he's not gay, therefore he is straight. And right. there's no more question or no more conversation about gender and sexuality. And that definitely, I think, is problematic and definitely something that we, you know, as scholars want to make sure that is not lost to, because it was, you know, very important, you know, to identity and to our history of what Prince was doing, you know, right, particularly in those early years.
And I think some of that, what Chris mentions, comes from just folks being reductionist about those terms. Like you said, just equating queer equals gay, or like you were referencing earlier, Zach. And I think that Chris kind of touched on this, and something that I don't think I will explicitly said yet, but is that the term queer is inherently a political term in a lot of ways too, right? Because I feel like it's not like queer said gay could be queer and queer could be gay, but like when a person uses that term, it's a very particular kind of statement that it's you know, challenging this binary, like Chris said, of this kind of deterministic understanding of self or of people. And so I think whether or not, again, he may have used that term, I think it is important, like Chris said, to keep up those conversations, because what his work was political in different ways, you know, whether it's just, you know, literally political towards the end of his life and the work he did supporting Black Lives Matter, that type of thing. But also, like you said, Zach, his earlier work, that was definitely political in the sense that it challenged these systems. And so inherently he was taking a stand. And so I think that it's okay in that sense to utilize the term queer as far as what he did, you know, to queer and challenge these things, because that was definitely on purpose, you know. So I think, like Chris said, we don't want to lose that, because that's such a foundational part of who he was and still is.
Are there any other panels that either of you want to mention that you especially like? I know Zahir Ali,
right?
And I can't remember who else was on that.
Tarika Blackman and Keith Morris, yeah,
right.
Those three were, that was a powerhouse. Monique, I believe it's the National Black Women's Justice Initiative. She does a lot of work around the push out of African-American and Latino girls in schools, and she talked about the concept of mastery, Prince's concept of self-mastery, and I don't even want to like attempt to explain it, because she did such a beautiful job. And then Jericho was also on that panel and spoke about more related to kind of the spirituality, but also the legacies and histories of Black spiritual resistance. Would you say that's how to characterize that one, Chris, of Jerika's?
I think so, right, of the like Black liberation.
Yeah.
Theology,
liberation theology. The, yeah.
Right.
And Zahir with the labor politics. I didn't get to go see Joyce, like I said, but Joyce's title was real clever. It was "When Were You Mine?" It was like Prince in the context of transgender history or something like that. And I really, the one thing I'd say, I think all of us felt, was that all of the gender and sexuality panels were at the same time. So we didn't actually get to go here. And I know that came up in other podcasts, that we didn't, some of the folks we would have maybe especially loved to hear their work, we didn't all get to go to each other's because of that. The esoteric French one, that was great. Yeah. I don't know.
I think we did attend a lot of the same
sessions. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So yeah, the esoteric French as well. I'm not sure if you did attend this one, Eric, Natalie, but the Erica's on the spirituality. Like I think that was the final presentation that I saw, and that was again, just, you know, very much falls within my own specific interest area, and that was really great to look at that kind of religious context throughout his career, and as well the geographies, you know, the idea of Prince, you know, being from Minneapolis and having the influence of Minneapolis, you know, kind of counter to the idea of the, you know, the Dick Clark introduction that is like, oh my God, how did you come out of Minneapolis? And it's like, well, because all of these things are happening in Minneapolis, and I've been listening to them. So,
yeah,
that was a that was another great one.
Ladies and gentlemen, the revolution.
So let's talk a little bit about the papers themselves. And I don't know if this is going to be a transition into your topic or not, Natalie, but I was struck by, you know, so you mentioned, you know, your work was on kind of talking about, younger people, I guess, you know, sort of early teens, I guess, basically.
Yeah.
About, you know, about sexual violence and preventing sexual violence. And you also mentioned that one of the things that kind of got you into Prince early on was watching Purple Rain, which I think a lot of people, you know, on the surface, at least, those are two things that are fairly at odds with one another. So I'm curious, you know, what, like, I'm curious, I guess, first, before you get into your paper, like, you know, what was it about Purple Rain that appealed to you? Because there's definitely some some troubling stuff, yes, in that movie as well.
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because so again, this is the part where I feel like it's you know, like you were mentioning earlier. So me being around all these folks who've grown up with Prince, I felt like not like a like I didn't belong at first, but I was just like, oh man, there's so much I don't know, right, or things I haven't seen or listened to. And so I had never seen Under the Cherry Moon actually before the conference, and I loved it. And of course, I got super emotional because I hadn't seen it. And my, one of my favorite songs ever is Mountains. And, you know, of course, that plays a huge. I was just like, it was waterworks, man. I was totally losing it. But, but I think you're right, of course, to mention a lot of the troubling, especially violent aspects of Purple Rain. I think that for me, honestly, the initial part was that I had grown up in Minnesota, and I was just beginning to live in the big city of Minneapolis, and I was like, this is like, I know Prince is a big deal, but I feel like so much of being growing up in Minnesota was just Prince was, he was from Minnesota, and we were lucky we had him, and I don't think I really fully realized how big of a deal he was outside of Minnesota. And so seeing him, I was like, oh, like there's this whole movie that he made, and just honestly the kind of novelty of that, the clothing and the fashion, there were a couple of panels I didn't get to attend, but I know there were a few like dress historians at the conference speaking about very particularly the clothing, not just from that era, but especially looking at his 80s clothing. So I think it wasn't any real deep thing that got me into it at first. And I know part of what I realized too going to this conference is that, you know, a lot of people say, oh, Purple Rain is their entrance. And, you know, for those folks, unlike myself, who really grew up with everything of Prince, that's kind of just very a surface level. There's so much else to see, but that was my entrance, just being honest. I think the other thing about it that struck me was that, kind of like Chris alluded to, there was this person who was, he's so short, he's so small, but you know, he's so completely commanding in his presence and his, the way that he moved and sang and interacted, just like completely in control without shame about his sexuality, like I said. And myself, you know, identify as a woman, but at that time I was just beginning to come out, and part of that was wrapped up in all that, and like you said, you know, gender, sexuality, all these things are related. And that was, although I don't necessarily share all of these identities with Prince, it still was very powerful to me to see that on screen. Again, noticing the troubling aspects of some of the other parts, but just in that in itself, I was just totally fascinated, and I didn't know what to say about it, and so I mean, I really was like actually embarrassed, but I like couldn't look away, you know, because I was like, what is this? And I had not, all I knew was some of his songs, and so I hadn't understood him as so much of what he was was about was sort of the spirituality of sexuality, and I had never experienced that before or seen that. I think there's so much shame in our society in general, and then when you sometimes, depending on your upbringing, if you bring religion into that, that can have a real impact on people's lives. And so for me, it was sort of like gave permission to have those conversations with myself and reflect on those things and begin to just kind of understand who I was or am, I guess you could say.
I think everyone, to some extent, you have to take the good parts of Purple Rain. I think everyone takes those with there's some negotiation there, you know, both because of the kind of sexist and, you know, violent elements, and then also just because it's not always a great movie, just in general. But I think the sense of place is so amazing, and I have to imagine, like, especially being in Minneapolis and being able to, like, I would guess, like, literally recognize neighborhoods and street scenes, First Avenue, and areas.
I mean, I'd been there, and I've been there a bunch of times in my life, First Avenue, and I was like, oh, like, wow, like, it's right there, you know. And and there was someone at the conference, I'm sure there's multiple people, it was Carmen Hoover, I believe, from Washington, who actually worked part of that, like the shooting, the scenes, I think, when they shot the concert, like scenes at First Avenue, she worked it and was there. So that was so amazing to me to talk to her about that. But yeah, I mean, I've been to First Avenue a lot. And so sometimes I do feel like we took him for granted in Minneapolis. And I certainly feel like I did not. I kind of was at the end of the party, like you said, I feel like. But yeah.
Yeah. So but regardless of how it connects to Purple Rain, tell me a little bit about your work with these students and, sure. and how that turned into the paper.
Yeah. Well, I have always, ever since I had first come out, like I said, which would be about now, gosh, like coming up on 8 years, I'd say, which is around the time that I had seen the film. I, after kind of coming into my own understanding of self, I realized that I, you know, I'm very close to my family. I love my family, but I just did not have that kind of role model growing up or people talking openly about these topics. And I think a lot of us in the queer community or queer communities don't have that. And it's becoming more of a, not, I don't want to say a norm, but I have friends who are queer or trans, and they are more, they're very proactively, you know, surrounding their children with queer adults, queer trans adults, just normalizing it and being very proactive in the ways that they speak about those topics with their youth and or with their children around identities. And so for me, I don't have children. I'm a dog mother, that's it. But but I mean, I am the oldest of a bunch of kids and cousins, and I just naturally enjoy working with people younger than myself. And so I this was honestly kind of like the dream job that I had, which was, like I said, every week I was at a different school. And so the first topic I'd cover, I was there for 5 days, but the foundational topic before we got into anything else about violence prevention with dating violence or abuse was to talk about masculinity, because we separated the students based on it's flawed, right? Because it's the binary system, but we're in the school, so it's sort of like, what can you do? But so I was working with the young men, and I remember when I got hired, my boss was like, okay, you have more experience with working with young men, so you'll take them and your coworker will take the girls. And I was like, I personally at first didn't feel qualified for that, but I actually really enjoyed it a lot. And so what I would do was really, we would define what the word masculine meant, because some of them have maybe heard it, but they weren't quite sure. And said, okay, so the way I would phrase it was, what are the kinds of things that you hear that tell you, like, as a guy, what are guys supposed to be? Like, are guys supposed to cry? Are they supposed to show their feelings? Are they supposed to be tall, strong, whatever? And I'd kind of pull it out. They threw out, because they know, even if they didn't have the word masculinity, they know these things, right? They recognize the messages they're getting from the media, from peers, from parents, guardians, whoever. And so I would kind of then flip it at the end. I'd say, okay, but like, so we're told guys are not supposed to have feelings, they're not supposed to cry, they're supposed to be strong. And I was like, raise your hand if that's every guy you've ever met has been like tall and buff and strong. And like, they're like, well, no, duh, miss. Like, they're middle schoolers, so they're like 11. They're like, duh, obviously not. And I'm like, okay, cool. So I'd say, so raise your hand, like, if, you know, if you think all guys don't have any feelings. And then it's sort of like, it got to the, like, the way I would set it up was like, this is obviously ridiculous. Like, these expectations aren't realistic, right? Because, you know, you are allowed to express yourself, and that's totally a normal and human thing. And so really just helping these young men on that first day, then I built that relationship where then throughout the rest of the week, we could then challenge other ideas around violence and sort of myths, honestly, that there's a lot of shame and stigma that, you know, young, you know, boys and men do experience sexual violence, but there's a lot of silencing around that. And so kind of talking to them about why, you know, what, tying it back to masculinity, they'd say, oh, that might be why someone might not come forward or might not say something if something happened, because they're afraid that they're going to be perceived as less whatever, you know, less masculine. And so so throughout those conversations, it was very powerful to me to see the ways that, I mean, I love working with youth, and I do think that because they are younger, they are impressionable, but they're also more, in a positive way, they're more open to challenging things as they see, you know, the problems they see in the world. And so I did feel, whereas sometimes I feel like I lose patience with adults because people are just very, we're all very set in our ways sometimes. But youth, I talked about Bell Hooks in my paper, who writes about youth being basically the best teachers in a lot of ways, because they are not fully bought into this, you know, system of norms, or they recognize it, but they're not fully convinced always that that's the way it has to be. So that's how then I came to be at the conference because I was doing that work and I heard about the conference and I was like, oh, in my dreams, I'd love to go to this conference. And I had a bunch of friends and coworkers who said, you know, you really could have something to say, though. You love Prince, and he has a lot to do with those conversations, not just because you love him, but because he actually, you know, he actually does. And so that's how I then came to throw my hat in the ring, and that's how I made it there.
So your paper was literally about how you incorporated Prince as a teaching experience, basically.
Yeah, I spoke about, basically, I did reference my work, but I also just kind of overall touched on the ways that I saw Prince as challenging masculinity. So I spoke about, there's zillions of examples we could come up with, right? But I shared some of the standout examples to me and the ways that he challenged gender expression and masculinity. And then I spoke about you know, what I did see in the classrooms when working with youth. And then I also spoke about kind of the shift in attitudes amongst millennials and what's called Generation Z, who are even like the generation behind me, and kind of these shifts in attitudes that we've seen, where more and more folks don't identify with the binary gender, or they recognize, even if they do, that's not how all folks are, and that more folks identify as not straight, and just kind of these shifts and in the ways people identify, do or don't identify. And then lastly, I talked about the fact that we can't just be all hunky-dory. It's not like everything's fixed. You know, like I said, there are, I think it was this year, I got a count, but 20-something trans folks, I was trying to pull up the list earlier, have been killed this year. And most of those are trans folks of color. And so I think for me, the important thing is to always bring in, you know, these theories are not just theories, but they matter, you know, in real life. And that's what I saw with youth. And also that, you know, I can sit here and talk about this, but at the end of the day, you know, we can talk about, you know, pushing boundaries and stuff. But when people do that, there's a lot of risk involved. And unfortunately and tragically, that can end in death sometimes. So that's why I kind of ended with saying, you know, that's why this work has to continue. And that's why I think Prince's legacy is so important, because it's not over yet. And I see the things that I see with youth, and I sort of, we may spark that conversation, but there's, it has to be a constant vigilant challenge that we're all as adults, I think, setting that example with them, because the moment you slip up, then that's when, you know, violence is given permission to continue. And I mean, I don't mean to get into it, but obviously we're seeing a lot of that nowadays with a lot of rhetoric that's violent. So I think that's more important than ever to challenge it. So.
What are, you know, we don't, like you said, we can go all day with examples, but what are a few of the examples just that you mentioned?
Oh, well, and I'm sure Chris can think of plenty too when he talks about his, but the ones that I spoke about were, let's see here, I talked about the song Controversy, even just lyrically alone, you know, when he says, I just can't believe all the things people say, am I black or white, am I straight or gray? Gay, not gray, sorry. I can't understand human curiosity, you know, just was I what you wanted me to be? So I spoke about that. I can't understand human curiosity. Controversy. Was it good for you? Was I what you wanted me to be? Controversy. Do you get high? Does your daddy cry? I spoke about, of course, I would die for you, and when he says there's so many different ways people interpret, I'm not a woman, I'm not a man, I'm something you'll never understand. Right. Of course, everyone, practically every panel, people talk about if I was your girlfriend, which goes without saying. So those are some of the ones that I spoke about, and Uptown. I mean, that's just literally, that's like a tiny sampling from like his earliest work, and I think so much, but those are the ones I brought up.
Yeah, I think this is, like you said, I think this is really, it's an important area to be talking about Prince. I think it's a place where his influence is definitely still felt. I think there, for some young people, I almost feel like Prince is more influential at this point for his gender expression than for his music.
Sure.
One thing I thought was really interesting was after Prince died, the rapper Young Thug, who is, you know, known for a kind of unusual gender expression. Mm-hmm. You know, he definitely, like, he paid tribute to Prince at a couple of shows. His music has so little in common with Prince. It's like, I don't think he took, you know, anything from him musically.
Sure.
But I think without Prince and without David Bowie, it would be difficult to imagine a rapper, you know, wearing a dress on his album cover.
Yeah.
Of course, there are, you know, like, in terms of Young Thug's gender politics and his lyrics, it's considerably less progressive. You know, so that's kind of, again, there's this area where we're not quite 100% there yet.
Right.
Like even the young people who are really, you know, sort of invested in pushing these boundaries, they still feel the need to kind of you know, back up their masculinity in other ways.
Right.
You know, so you can be wearing a dress, but you still have to you know, also like, you know, make sure that people know that you could kick their ass, like,
right.
You know, or you know, or maybe, you know, disrespecting women in other ways. I definitely think it's an interesting time that we're living in. Mm-hmm. Because you see, you know, much more, you know, a much wider range of gender expression in not only in popular culture, but just in general.
Mm-hmm.
But then it also feels in some ways like things are more conservative now than they were, you know, at least 10 years ago. Probably not since the 80s. Things were pretty bad in the 80s. But yeah, it's sort of, we're kind of moving in two directions at once, where it's both more progressive and at the same time also more regressive.
Yeah, a lot of the things that are coming up or have been, you know, bubbling right before below the surface, or people have been saying, you know, these things have been going on, but now they're kind of just getting more exacerbated, even in an extremely violent form, like you said. And I think, to me, that speaks to the urgency of, you know, of a lot of this work, because those of us who love Prince, I think, see that he wasn't just an artist, but he was an artist activist, or an activist artist, however you want to say it, or scholar activist, who didn't just create art, but like Prince, or like Chris said, he was very purposeful, and so I think that is, like he's, like Chris said, that's just the legacy that we're all trying to uphold and continue and make sure doesn't fall off. And I'd say, last thing I'll say, then you should totally ask Chris about his, is Janelle Monáe is an artist that I think, she was very, very close with Prince, and I think she is really working to continue that legacy. There's a million ways you could say that, but I mean, as she sees herself as an artist activist at the same time, and has challenged a lot, all kinds of systems of oppression, whether through gender, race, all forms, really. And so I know she's been very devoted and outspoken about continuing his legacy. So she's one that I think truly understands what he was about and was so close with him that she's working to do that. But new power, give it to me. Oh, we need some bottom in the air.
So yeah, let's hear a little bit more about your paper, Chris.
All right, yeah. So oh, and also you couldn't hear Natalie, but I was giving you snaps through pretty much all of the, all of your things you were saying. So, New Power, Sexuality and Emancipation, The Revolutionary Prince Through a Foucauldian Lens was my complete title. And so I kind of then broke it down within those, looking at his work in the way that he framed it, of new power, sexuality, emancipation, and then kind of put each of those through a queer lens. It was definitely one of those that in retrospect, it like I could have done a complete paper on just one of those things. So it was kind of overwhelming when I had to write it. I was like, oh my God, there's too much information. And so it's definitely something, yeah, that I'm digging deeper into. But, you know, starting again with, say, sexuality, I mean, I think that one is a really obvious link within queerness. I guess the one unfortunate thing in terms of with that framing, I also definitely wanted to look at and did look at gender and, you know, that kind of too of where I think in those times when he was creating that work, that it was at a point when we were still looking at like gender and sexuality as being synonymous. Right. So now a lot of what I want to talk about gender, I feel like it doesn't fit under sexuality, but, you know, particularly just the honest expression, I think, you know, of sexuality and just this, the celebration of it, especially, you know, I think that was more queer in the 80s than it is now, in that regard of it being, you know, something that wasn't, was taboo in a lot of other realms. And that he did very much tackle that, like as a subject matter. And, you know, I remember one of, you know, an essay from the 80s talking about, you know, the difference of cracking the door open but he like completely just like ripped it off the hinges, you know, of, you know, in how he did approach sexuality. New power, I think that too, like power dynamics, particularly when you're looking at queer theory through a Foucauldian lens, that power is key to most of Foucault's work, and looking at the idea of who is in power and who has power, and the idea that that there's always power in resistance. And so I think that too of, you know, for someone where Prince was coming from, of being very much, you know, even to the identity of like the revolution, of being about resistance, that did, you know, give him an innate power as being someone who was pushing back against, you know, what the norms were. Just that idea of kind of creating a whole something new, like a rebirth in that sense of like a power structure, of saying like, you know, we want to create this different world that does, you know, going back to the song New Power Generation, of, you know, getting rid of the old ideas,
right?
And, you know, we're sick of that, and, you know, referencing that too of, you know, put down your funky weapons, of, you know, putting in still that same kind of imagery around revolution and talking about war and fighting and resisting, and, you know, and then within that birthing a new power. And I think that, you know, clearly was very important to Prince, that idea of new power, as that, you know, then became something that I think was the label that was attached to him and his performances or his band for longer than I think any other incarnation, you know, even though it was something that was constantly changing. And again, that in itself, again, goes back to queerness and the idea that it wasn't like the revolution or, you know, the band with no name, the
right,
sexy band, you know, that it was, this is a constant thing that is always changing, but it's still always, it's always the NPG, it's always this, but at the same time, it's always something different. I think the symbol particularly of that change, both the approach of just saying like, oh, I'm going to use a unpronounceable name, and to do that, you know, before releasing an album, and that too, you know, like working, you know, with a major record label at a point when that was a very, you know, the way that music was released, to just say, no, I'm not going to do that. I don't, that's not my name anymore. Like this is who I am. And to then very much tie it into, this is about my identity, you know, as both in terms of it's the combination of male and female, and it's within that tradition, you know, like you mentioned of Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali, that, you know, it is me determining who I am you know, and taking the power to do that. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of some basics.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. Prince really did, you know, your paper kind of throws this into relief. He didn't really articulate any of these all that much. Right. They're definitely, we do have to like unpack, but he really did create a series of sort of philosophies, and even, I mean, with like Love Sexy, it was even getting to the point of like cosmology even, yep. You know, like just making these whole ways of thinking that I think are in some ways consistent across his career. There are also, you know, differences from one period to the next, sort of subtly in terms of what he was emphasizing and, you know, what kind of fell to the wayside. But I mean, really, ever since Controversy, when that album came out, he really did seem invested in thinking about different ways to live, different ways to be, to, you know, to exercise power, like you said, in that sort of, you know, Foucauldian way. Yeah, I think that's a really interesting aspect of his career, and you know, that it's not always easy to see what he was talking about when right. he was in that right. mode, but I think it's rewarding to kind of dig into
right.
it.
Right, and I think one of the interesting things that I found in the Foucault work was a lot of his ideas about being an artist and how those those very strongly tied in with Prince. And one, you know, the first one just being the idea of that the art and the artist are one thing, and you know that you can't separate, you can't pull the art out of the artist or the artist away from the art, that they, you know, it's one entity. And I think that I think Prince really embodied that, of, you know, it wasn't just something that he made or something that he did, that it was part of an entire, right. you know, he did live his art. And in that too, there was a really good quote in Maite's book that also, you know, where she talked about that and what how he had impressed that upon her, of like, you know, the idea that basically you can make a choice to be an artist in every choice you make throughout the day, that, you know,
right.
And that too, I think, of just embodying that art, and then when your art is also resisting, like it is, you're a constant you know, in that state of revolution and resistance, and then, you know, developing that power as someone who is in resistance, and, you know, again, in just like the queer theory ideas of queering, that he very much did that by, you know, he didn't play by the rules and didn't do you know, I'm going to go on a 2-year tour because that's what the industry says you're supposed to do after a big album. Or, you know, one of the things I looked at specifically, just in terms of like output, and I don't remember the specific numbers, but I counted, you know, just all of the releases that Prince did in, I think I did like a 3 to 4 year period. Right. And, you know, just looking at the affiliated artists and songs that he, you know, gave to other artists, and then compared that to Michael Jackson, Madonna, and Bruce Springsteen in that same period.
Right.
And just to look at that output of that in itself was so, you know, where other people are like, oh, well, the label only wants an album every 2 years, so that's all I'm going to do. Whereas like that right. was what the label wanted or was dictating was not a concern to Prince, you know,
right. Right.
You know, until the time that, you know, until it specifically did become, and then he's like, okay, well, let's fight about it. Cause like, this is how I make music. This is how I live and what I do. And I'm not going to, you know, give you an album every 3 years so that you can, you know, release all the singles. And that's, again, you know, I think it's easy to look at it and be like, oh, well, you know, he is a multimillionaire and he's an artist and he could do whatever he wanted. But it's like, right. yes, he could, but he didn't. He definitely consistently made the choice to do and express himself the way he wanted. I mean, even at times, obviously, you know, much to our frustration, that we didn't like the things that he did or the way,
yeah.
Like, why did he release that version? Or, you know, why did he do that album when we know he just did this? He did what he wanted to do and what was right for him.
Let's play a game called You Agree, because nothing was created in disagreement. See? And if I didn't try to school you, I'd be remiss. You know what? Why should I do that when I can do this?
I've never really thought about it that way. I mean, obviously, you know, we all know that Prince was extremely prolific, but it's interesting that, you know, he was, at least when Purple Rain came out, he was in a position where he did not have to make another album within, you know, 10 right. months or whatever it was. But he did anyway. It was all like it seemed like he kind of had to.
Right.
The process of art was for him, I think, almost completely detached from the sort of commercial cycles.
Right.
It was almost a coincidence that they would sometimes, or that they had to align.
You know, I think especially, you know, looking at Purple Rain now and some of the stories that have come out, and just that, yeah, that by the end of the tour, I mean, he was just completely done. Like, didn't, you know, he had already done so many other different things musically that it was like, I don't want to do Purple Rain. Like, I need to do something
right.
different. I'm bored with that. I'm on, and that too. I mean, I think that, in terms of his creativity in that regard, that is very different. I think for, again, an artist working at his level, that typically it's like, well, you might be bored with it, but this is what you got to do. And you're like, okay, well, yeah, I'm going to go tour for 2 years because I can make $100 million if I do that. And mm-hmm. I'll just go back to the studio whenever, you know, whenever it's time. And that was not Prince by any means. I mean,
right.
The constant creation of music was, I think, very much a lifeblood to him that was very necessary. It's definitely, I think there's some other interesting areas that I want to dig deeper on. I think in the paper as I had it at the point that I went to the conference, I definitely did end up looking more at like kind of the milestones with Prince. That too, I think, and Nat and I talked about this kind of in a different context of going to an academic conference as someone who wasn't entirely an academic, being really unsure about, you know, once, you know, even though I had, you know, or, you know, any of us had our abstracts were accepted, it still at that point is, I'm like, okay, well, now what is the framework that I want to actually, you know, bring all of this in? And what I ultimately decided in terms of going to a Prince conference was that the, you know, the focus should be on the Prince side of it. And so, that was what I think I did more of kind of looking at and finding those specific examples to say, you know, this is, you know, Prince doing something queerly, you know, or queering an idea. But right. now, I'm actually getting ready to present again, to a different non-Prince audience. and this one, actually, for this next one I'm doing, I kind of dropped the Foucault idea, but definitely I want to get back to it and get deeper into some of the Foucault text and look a lot more. I think there's going to be more things within the power structures to look at, and then just around a lot of his ideas with sexuality and identity. Those are definitely things that I want to look deeper into.
Why would I do that, y'all? Spike, when I could do this. Why would I do that, y'all? MPG, we can do this. So, you know, you mentioned future work. You know, there are a few more conferences coming up. There's the conference coming up in Minneapolis. Are either of you thinking about presenting at that, or?
I go first, Chris. Sounds like you're working on something.
I am working on an abstract to submit to the Minneapolis conference. So, fingers crossed. I think the deadline's in a couple weeks, so I gotta get it wrapped up.
Yeah, I am. I think the deadline is like next weekend or something. And I have been intending to work on it, but it's my first year teaching, and I've been drowned a bit, unfortunately, in that. I have a bunch of grades due tomorrow, so that's what I've been doing all weekend. But I have some ideas. I've written down some notes for kind of brainstorming. Because I'm not doing the same work that I was at the time of the conference, I'm trying to figure out. I mean, I still have lots to say about that, but I don't want to do the exact same thing. And so my goal is to be able to put something together this week, because if it's just the abstract, then I can write the actual paper, you know, later if it gets accepted. More so than anything, almost just because it would be really neat to have the opportunity to see a lot of those folks again, because I think a high percentage, at least, of the folks from what I've seen, there's a Facebook group that we're on. It seems like a lot of folks are applying to be part of it. And even though it was such a short conference in Salford in Manchester, even during that brief time, it was such an intense connection that a lot of us built, I think, for many different reasons. But that really motivates me. And I mean, I really do want to go. I haven't been back to Minneapolis in quite a while now. So it'd be cool to see all those folks and experience the city with them in that different way. So I'd like to put something together, but as of this time, there's nothing hot off the presses yet. Are you going to try to go, do you think, Zach?
I am. I have not. My like abstract process, I'm very sort of cocky about it. I always like just wait until the last minute, and I've got an idea. I just need to put it into 500 or 300 words or whatever. So I will try to do that before next Saturday. I'd really love to go. I think it's, you know, as someone who is a former academic and is still sort of interested in, you know, quasi academic things like this podcast. It's so exciting to see this kind of scholarship around prints take off, because I've always thought that there's a lot to say. You know, I can't imagine too many other artists that I could legitimately see, you know, multiple academic conferences being dedicated just to him. But, you know, when I was teaching college, I would do my whole gender unit. I would basically structure around Prince, because there was just so much there. You know, there was queer, and there was, you know, gender fuck, and there was any number of, you know, you could just choose a different Prince video for all of the different topics. So I found a way to like force my my Prince obsession into that.
Hey, right, that's kind of what I feel students. Like the good opportunity for, right? In a sense of how it all fits together. Yeah, that's well. I hope that you're able to go. I hope all of us are able to make it out there. It's a good group. The group,
yeah,
in Manchester. And I think it's just given the timing of what happened in Manchester, also made it pretty profound time to be in Manchester because of the events that unfortunately occurred. And I think a lot of folks said they thought that Prince would be honored to have an academic conference about him. He'd probably be very intrigued by that. And I think that's true. I think he would have enjoyed it.
Right. Oh, and I do also, I mentioned the geography panel. Rashad Shabazz was the presenter. I wanted to do a shout out to him. And he also just recently published an article around that idea that was on a Zocalo, I think was the website. It was something with the University of Arizona, but it's a great, great piece.
I need to look that up.
Yeah, I'll send you a link.
Okay, great.
But yeah, because it's a really good solid piece. 1, 2, 3, 4.
So yeah, I mean, I think I'm surprised. I think we covered a lot of ground in a relatively short amount of time. So, I mean, is there anything that we've missed that either one of you want to make sure that we talk about?
I guess the one thing I would say that we've all kind of touched on that I think was really important about this conference and about Prince's work was that Chris mentioned, and I mentioned this too, that not being an academic at first, I was very intimidated even from the idea of applying to present, and then seeing actually how many folks there were, non-traditional scholars, I guess you could say, right. or community workers, community activist types. I think that that's very reflective of Prince's work and his spirit. And the ways that I think, you know, he was highly intelligent, obviously, and really self-aware, but he wasn't, I mean, I wouldn't overall characterize him as someone who strove to be elitist. You know, he knew himself well, and I think that he was very much about empowering not only himself, but other people, and so I think it speaks a lot to his influence and legacy that so many of the folks there were certainly academics, and that was awesome, but it was definitely a good mix of folks there that no, I didn't feel there was any type of pretension. It was very welcoming. People were so kind and just instantly very open and excited and enthusiastic to learn from each other. It was a community of learners, I think, that you could see how powerful his legacy was to see that many people come from all over the world and be like excited to learn and nerd out and talk about from all these different perspectives. So I think that says a lot about what he's leaving behind and what he will, and all the folks who couldn't be there that wanted to. It's a lot of what we spoke about, some other folks at the conference, including Harold Pride. I know his panel was mentioned a few times on other podcasts, but just about how do we then continue this legacy, not just amongst those of us who are attending, but like this, you know, making things available online for folks. I know that they there's talks of a book. So just making sure other people can access it, because there's so many more people I'm sure would love to be there. But that's what I feel like Prince was about too, having access and to knowledge and information and creating knowledge. And so, yeah.
It's just great to see it. The community that sprung up around it, all of the dialogue that's come up around it. I mean, you know, this happened back in May, and it's now September, and I still have people like contacting me like, hey, do you want to talk about this on the podcast? You know, like it's just so cool to like see it keep rolling. And I hope it continues in one way or another into the future. So yeah, I mean, I think we've covered it. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. This was great fun.
Yeah. Thank you, Chris, for reaching out to Zach to follow up on it, and Zach for your time.
And of course, thank you for listening. We have more coming up in the future, both from Purple Rain Conference presenters. Yes, there's at least one more of those. And just general other exciting things planned. So please subscribe. If you like us, shoot us a review on your podcast service of choice. And in the meantime, of course, you can check out the podcast and the blog, Dance, Music, Sex, Romance, at princesongs.org. Thank you very much. Goodbye. That's it.